I don't care how old you are. I don't care how technically challenged you deem yourself to be. If you are not on social media every single day.
It's a little bit of Sebastian Gorka to lead us in this week. My name is Jared Holt, and I'm the host of Shitpost. It's a weekly podcast at the intersection of politics and online culture. We've been away for a little bit. I've had some stuff come up in my personal life between the passing of my grandfather, some travel. I want to thank all you guys for the supportive messages you've sent me and the support. I'm very happy that, you know, this community that has formed around this podcast is very positive. And on a personal note, I really appreciate how understanding you guys are and compassionate. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you. To get the latest updates on this podcast and to support the show, if you're feeling generous, you can go to shtpost.substack.com. You can sign up and get free emails anytime a general newsletter or a episode comes out. Occasionally, there's bonus newsletters and bonus audio interviews, the most recent one being a unlocked interview with Michael Buchert. That's $5 a month or 50 bucks a year. If you can't support it that way, a nice review on iTunes or wherever you're listening to the podcast is always appreciated. It really does help us a lot. The past couple weeks, we've gone without a show. I gotta say, this is not the couple of weeks I would have picked, but life does not come that way. There was a lot of shit went down, a lot of shit has hit the fan, but that's what I'm here for. So, let's go. Public service announcement. So after a whole lot to do complaining about conspiracy theories and unhinged rhetoric coming from the president, we've got Hillary Clinton out here now pointing fingers and accusing Democratic primary challengers of being Russian assets. This one made the rounds. It made a bunch of headlines. So on Thursday, Hillary Clinton, former Secretary of State, went on a podcast with David Plouffe. He's a former Obama advisor. Clinton told Plouffe that Russians were grooming a Democratic candidate to be a third-party candidate. And she didn't directly mention Tulsi Gabbard by name, but it seemed pretty clear who she was talking about. The subtext was not exactly subtle. Here's what that sounded like.
I'm not making any predictions, but I think they've got their eye on somebody who's currently in the Democratic primary and are grooming her to be the third party candidate. She's the favorite of the Russians. They have a bunch of sites and bots and other ways of supporting her so far.
So, I mean, to point out that Tulsi Gabbard has positions and policy stances, particularly foreign policy stances, that would make her appealing to the Russians is not inaccurate. It is not a stretch. It is also not inaccurate or a stretch. In fact, it's correct to say that the sort of operations, the troll farms, the bots, the clickbait websites that were examined and cataloged and identified during investigations into Russian election interference have started to swing towards Gabbard. That is also correct. But Clinton takes it a step further and goes into conspiracy land. She says that the Russians are grooming Tulsi to be a third-party challenger. You know, Clinton campaign people have often blamed like Jill Stein and whatnot for spoiling the 2016 election. You know, essentially just anything to try to come to terms with the fact that Hillary Clinton was not a good candidate. And a lot of that argument in itself is kind of garbage, I think. It assumes that people who voted third party would have voted for a Democrat otherwise, and I don't think that's accurate. I don't think there's data to really show that that is accurate. But anyway, now we've got a fight on our hands, and it's happening mostly online. In response to headlines about Clinton's podcast claims, Tulsi Gabbard tweeted, "Thank you, Hillary Clinton. You, the queen of warmongers, embodiment of corruption and personification of the rot that has sickened the Democratic Party for so long, have finally come out from behind the curtain." Tulsi also put out a really bizarre video on Twitter. I'll play some of that now.
"People warned me in 2016 that my endorsement of Bernie Sanders would be the end of my quote-unquote political career. They said Clinton will never forget that she and her rich and powerful friends, her allies in politics and in the media, will make sure that you are destroyed. Well, there have been countless hit pieces full of smears against me from day one of this campaign. They've tried to destroy my reputation and my lifetime of service because I stood up to them. I've spent over 16 years of my life proudly serving in the Army National Guard. I still serve as a major today. I volunteered to deploy to the Middle East twice."
Okay, I think we're done here. So, you get the gist. I mean, if I'm mad about anything, I'm mad that Hillary is putting me in a position where I feel like I have to correct the record in defense of Tulsi Gabbard, who, personally, I am not a fan of at all. Some of her policy positions, I do think, you know, sound good, but Tulsi herself is reportedly a religious extremist, and I really, really disagree with sort of the aspect, the outlook on foreign policy as it has manifested, you know, because it manifests itself a little bit differently than how she presents it. You know, there's been all these rumors, and like the MAGA crew has convinced themselves that Hillary is going to run again for president, and I kind of wish she would just get in or get out and, you know, just... I don't know. I'm going to move on from this. This is making me frustrated. In other Democratic primary news, on the debate stage last week, Kamala Harris called again for Twitter to suspend Donald Trump's account, which it should be, I think, if we were going to operate in a world where all the accounts are held to the same standards. Yes, Trump would be gone, but it's kind of complicated by the fact that he's the president of the United States. I don't know, but there was a moment where Kamala Harris keeps trying to push Elizabeth Warren on stage to say, like, will you demand that Twitter suspends Trump? And eventually Elizabeth Warren is just like, no, stop, we're not doing this.
He and his account should be taken down. We saw in El Paso that shooter in his manifesto was informed by how Donald Trump uses that platform. And this is a matter of corporate responsibility. Twitter should be held accountable and shut down that site. It is a matter of safety and corporate accountability.
Thank you. Senator Warren, you can respond.
So, look, I don't just want to push Donald Trump off Twitter. I want to push him out of the White House. That's our job.
Join me in saying that his Twitter account should be shut down.
Let's figure out.
No.
Why it is that we have had laws...
Calls like this to suspend Trump's Twitter account aren't new. They're not unique, really. I mean, tons of people, tons of groups have made arguments for kicking Trump off the platform because some of his tweets violate the terms of service, or they include racist content, or they could potentially incite violence. But ultimately, if you're going to make this argument that, you know, Twitter as a private platform has its own autonomy to be able to decide it can kick off racist and it's like not a problem, sort of the other edge of that sword is that Twitter can also decide what it wants to keep. And if it doesn't want to suspend the president, which is a huge source of traffic, it makes its site incredibly newsworthy. You know, you kind of have to swallow that pill, too. But in an ideal world where the rules of Twitter are enforced equally to all people, he would have been gone a long time ago, but it doesn't always work like that. There's still been protests and controversy as people in Hong Kong rebel against the government of China, and that has trickled into online gaming. Activision Blizzard has suspended three collegiate gamers for expressing support for the Hong Kong protest and advocating for a boycott of the company. This comes to us from the Daily Beast. The three players are American University students. What's up, DC? get at me, Casey Chambers, Corwin Dark, and one guy who's only known by his handle T-Jammer. They were playing a match, and they held up a sign that read Free Hong Kong Boycott Blizz during a Blizzard broadcast of a tournament for Hearthstone, which is a video game. It's like a digital card game, if that makes sense. After holding up that banner, they were banned from the league for 6 months. Those students were expressing support for another gamer who had been banned for speaking out in support of Hong Kong protesters during an official tournament broadcast from Taiwan. A lot of people are interpreting these decisions as the company sort of bowing down to China, which is a country that has outstandingly gross human rights violations. But Blizzard maintains that it's just trying to keep politics out of the equation entirely. Blizzard put out a statement last week on Friday saying that the relationship it has with China was, quote, not a factor in its decision to issue these bans, but the company's own employees staged a walkout on October 9th to protest how it is reacting to these players. Joining ShitPost now, we have April Glazer. She's a technology writer at Slate. April, what's up?
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. It's a real pleasure. I'm surprised I haven't had you on here yet, so I'm excited to get you on. You wrote a column last week at Slate that I thought was really interesting, and I wanted to talk with you about. It centered on a speech that Mark Zuckerberg gave to Georgetown University, in which he unveiled that Facebook was going to be, you know, the big free speech platform, blah-de, blah-de, blah. What exactly happened, like in layman's terms? I'm struggling to really put it down into spark notes. How would you summarize what Zuckerberg's appearance and speech was meant to communicate?
Sure. So he was trying to situate Facebook as kind of the premier platform, or kind of a place that's going to be protecting the fundamental American value and tradition of freedom of expression and free speech. And he said that this is going to be difficult. It's not easy because, you know, a lot of people, he said, and he didn't really say who these people are, but a lot of people would prefer Facebook to clamp down on free speech, to limit what people are allowed to say. But despite all of that, he's going to champion free speech as much as possible. Of course, there are concessions, he said, when it comes to speech that's dangerous, that's inciting violence. But he said as much as possible, Facebook is going to be a place where people can say as much as possible, even though it's a risky thing to do. And so he really positioned himself as the protector of this American value.
This seems to be a bit of a departure from the public stances that Facebook has claimed to hold whenever they've been criticized by activists, human rights organizations, and et cetera, for some of the more hateful and divisive content that is allowed not only to exist on Facebook, but to flourish on Facebook. Is this really a departure, or is it a reversal? How did you interpret this?
I didn't see it as a departure from previous responses. I mean, you know, certainly what I thought was interesting is that he was kind of positioning the categories of people, the human rights activists, the academics, the journalists, who have been critical of Facebook's general stance, which is kind of what he's saying he's going to adhere to, which is to allow people to post as much as possible and do as little as possible about that, that he's going to, you know, kind of double down on that stance. So I saw it less as a departure and more as like him validating what they've been doing for so long, which is looking the other way when people post things that are hateful or that do contain misinformation, including politicians, and that he's going to try to let as much speech go as possible. You know, it's complicated because when he's talking about, you know, speech here, he's talking about content that people post. And we know that some of that content is not has really incited a lot of violence. That Facebook's, you know, stance until now, which he seems to be defending and saying that they're going to continue to double down on, has allowed for a lot of hate to flourish and has pushed a lot of people off the platform and has even had some really treacherous consequences that has resulted in violence.
Yeah, and it's what really sort of seemed to catch Facebook in the crosshairs most recently before this speech was Facebook coming out and saying that it's not its job to police the speech of politicians, whether they make straight up false claims, hateful claims, you know, some of the more incendiary things you were talking about here. You know, it's you wrote in your column that this is part of like Zuckerberg framing Facebook as this neutral forum where every voice has equal weight, and you know, who are they to like be moderating what politicians put out to the people. But sort of the point that you made in your piece that I think is really important is that it's kind of an incomplete view and incomplete conception of this whole free speech issue online. I'd love to hear you explain that a little bit more.
Sure. I mean, the idea that, you know, you're going to let anybody speak and that's kind of, you're just providing this kind of open playing field, this level playing field where everybody gets a chance to speak, doesn't really work out that way in practice, because it's like, yes, we all do have the same rights, but when it comes down to it, where the rubber hits the road, we don't all experience those rights in the same way. And so if somebody, for example, is using their ability to speak freely to peddle in hate or to express violent views, then they're going to actually be infringing on the ability for those whom they're targeting that violence or that hate towards to be able to speak freely, because they can't do so safely. And so likewise, if they are not correcting politicians who are lying, then the answer to that, he says, is you know, more speech, right? The answer to stuff you don't like is to then contest it. But then you get in this kind of lockstep situation where you're constantly debating or debunking, you know, inaccuracies, and you're unable to actually have a productive political conversation. And so, you know, it gets to a point where, you know, you have to begin to kind of work to create spaces that really makes politics possible, right? This isn't about, you know, shutting down voices that you consider hateful to forward an agenda. It's saying, well, these voices are hateful and are not allowing other people to speak freely. And so, you know, we won't allow hate. Doesn't mean that you're forwarding a political agenda. It means that you're actually creating the space necessary in order for free speech to actually occur.
So April, in your ideal world, you know, what would you have maybe changed about Zuckerberg's speech, his sort of approach to his platform here, that you think would perhaps make it stronger?
I mean, you know, these are really difficult questions, but I think it's absolutely understandable, or, you know, and I don't know if Facebook would be able to do this well, but to at least, you know, at the minimum, not allow politicians to essentially, you know, pay to lie, right? Because he's saying they're no longer going to fact check, you know, politicians' ads, and so that means they're able to pay to promote inaccuracies. You know, it means that if somebody is inciting violence or promoting views that are hateful, and they're reported, that those reports are taken seriously and that they're acted upon. You know, we know that Facebook traditionally does not have a good track record of this. I mean, we look at, for example, from the Christchurch massacre. I mean, that was live broadcast on Facebook. That was an act of hate broadcast on Facebook. He murdered, you know, 50 people at two mosques in New Zealand earlier this year. And that stayed up for long enough for people to copy it, and it was reposted 1.5 million times in 24 hours. And so, you know, I want Facebook to just do better about, you know, proactively. And they say that, you know, they take down stuff before it even is posted and, you know, all these things. Yet we see over and over again when viral, when hate does go, when hate does get on Facebook and it goes viral, that they're unable to contain it. And so, you know, I just wish that it wasn't a place where, you know, perhaps its algorithms are tuned in such a way to promote the type of engagement or the type of kind of incendiary things that go viral. You know, I wish that they were perhaps, you know, fine-tuned in such a way to make sure that our information needs are being served, or the information needs of the communities that are consuming news on Facebook are being served. And I don't know what the answer to that is. That would require Facebook to do some assessment into what people actually need to know and need to see in order to engage meaningfully in their social and political lives. You know, that takes some auditing and some assessment from Facebook. But right now, there's certainly kind of, there's a tarmac, there's like a runway paved that is allowing for hate to go viral in a somewhat regular cadence, and then also we see rules that kind of lack the I would say guardrails to make sure that we're in a healthy political dialogue. For example, the stance where they're no longer going to be fact checking you know, ads from politicians and allowing them to actually pay to lie. So, you know, certain things I wish that they would begin to tweak to at least make our conversations a bit healthier. But there was news that came out. We're talking, you know, on Monday, October 21st, and Facebook did have a call with reporters today when it said that it did take down a cadre of accounts from Iran and Russia of inauthentic you know, accounts that were probably mm-hmm. run by state agencies running misinformation campaigns aimed at the U.S. And Facebook did say, or Mark Zuckerberg did say in his speech last week, the week before, that that they are going to continue to be proactive about taking down quote unquote inauthentic posts. So,
yeah. So, do you see any sort of potential room for error when, on one hand, you have the company saying, it's not our job to police political speech. It's not our job to fact check politicians or anything. While at the same time, you have what appears to be state-sponsored efforts to do essentially a repeat of what happened online in 2016, where there was just massive amounts of money, massive amounts of automated activity being used to sort of skew the conversation online and sort of further sow division and distrust.
I, you know, conflicts or however you want to put it, I think that a more consistent line of thinking would be: are we promoting and in fact profiting off of and allowing, you know, blatantly for content that is going to be creating an unhealthy political conversation that, as I said before, not serving the information needs of the users that come to Facebook and rely on Facebook to become informed and have the information that they need to vote meaningfully and kind of participate in the democratic process. And whether that it means, you know, ferreting out information that is coming from a troll campaign outside of the United States, or that's information that's coming from a candidate within the United States that, you know, but wherever that inaccurate information is coming from, it's muddying our ability to participate meaningfully in democratic life. And so I would rather see a more consistent line of thinking that says, well, we are going to do our best to keep our political conversations healthy, rather than delineate between, you know, quote unquote, inauthentic behavior that's, you know, from an account, from somebody, you know, that says they're someone and they're not actually that person, they're actually coming from you know, the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg, versus, you know, an ad from Trump that is a blatant lie. You know, I would rather not differentiate between those two things and just say these are behaviors that are causing us to not participate or to not have the information we need to vote, right? Because in order to vote, like, your vote is meaningless if you're voting with bad information. Not meaningless, but if you're voting with information that's not true.
Right. I always say that, like, people make decisions as good as the information that they have available.
Exactly. And this is about just preserving the spaces that we need in order to meaningfully participate in democratic life. And so, you know, I think that these differentiations or these distinctions are not as useful as just having kind of a baseline rubric that says, well, how are we going to foster healthy political conversations?
All right. We've been speaking with April Glazer. She's a technology writer at Slate. April, this is Shitpost, so I have one more question for you. What is your favorite thing online?
Well, I'll tell you, my least favorite thing online is probably Twitter, and that's because I'm a journalist and I'm on there all the time. But when it comes to my favorite thing online, you know, I said this when I was thinking about this question. You told me you were going to ask me this, and it's actually a really difficult question for me because, you know, 75% of my job is looking for stuff online that's awful, and so I try to spend time offline. But one thing I really do love and that I continue to engage in are kind of these citizen science apps. I'm really into identifying, like, you know, plants and birds and flowers. And so I'm really into eBird, which is where you can, like, list birds that you've seen and learn how to identify, as well as iNaturalist, which is an app that helps you identify, like, the native vegetation that you see around. And so I've actually learned a ton about, you know, plants that are not online, like walking around the city or a park or something, with these guides that I have from the internet. So I would say that's actually my favorite thing, and it's more of an homage to the offline world, but I definitely have to go online to learn about, you know, those spaces too. So
April, that is so wholesome and so sweet.
It just keeps, you know, if you're going to be online, it's good to learn about what's offline too. And I get a little tired of the internet. So if I'd say my favorite things online are the things that kind of force me to stop and smell the flowers.
Oh, words to live by. April, where can people keep up with you and what you're up to?
If you must, you can follow me on Twitter at April Laser. And I write for Slate. So slate.com. I'm there. You know, regularly I publish columns and investigations, so please check it out.
Ashley Feinberg did it again at Slate. She located what appears to be Mitt Romney's secret Twitter account. So McKay Coppins at The Atlantic published this big profile on Mitt Romney, and part of that profile included Mitt Romney admitting that he operated a secret Twitter account aside from his official ones. So at QAWS9876 really, really, really appears to be Mitt Romney if you want to go say hi. This is from Ashley Feinberg, fucking internet sleuth, incredible work. So here's what she found. Mitt Romney's secret account joined Twitter in July 2011, which was 1 month after Romney announced his run for president. Most of the people it follows are political reporters, politicians, political operatives, pundits. It follows late night hosts. It follows a couple athletes. It also appears that recently it became more active. Romney's secret account at QAWS9876, which has the display name Pierre Delecto, has tweeted 10 times, and they've all been replies to other tweets. The account's first tweet came 4 years after its initial registration, and it was just kind of moaning at a Fox News tweet for not having a New Hampshire poll up yet. So, you know, I can't say to go say hello to Mitt Romney, but if you were ever curious where he's lurking online. That seems to be the place. At the beginning of the episode, we had a clip from Sebastian Gorka. He was a former deputy assistant to the president, but his security clearance got pulled, I believe. So now he just exists on the conservative media talking circuit. And last week he was at Values Voters Summit, where he told the audience that, you know, all of you boomers owe it to Donald Trump to be active on social media for this president. And it's, I'll just play the clip.
You can write checks to candidates, you can knock on doors, be a poll monitor. It's all great, but it's not enough. It is not enough, because you know that they will be organized. You know they will cheat, lie, and bus people to the polling stations. So I ask you very simply to do the following. In addition to everything you've done as activists, as supporters of FRC, and I thank you on behalf of Tony and his great team, I want every single one of you to become what the military calls a force multiplier. I don't care how old you are, I don't care how technically challenged you deem yourself to be, if you are not on social media every single day supporting the president, you are part of the problem, not part of the solution.
This is just incredible to me. I mean, if Gorka's master plan, which I've heard him deliver in other settings since he said this, is enacted by the people that he's telling it to, we're going to have way more boomers on our hands. But what he's getting at is a valid social media strategy, I think. I mean, it makes sense in my head. This is something that trolls do a lot. They will, amplify, and something that, you know, speaking of from the beginning of this episode, this Russian election interference or whatever the hell you want to classify it as, part of what it did was it would find messages and use automated accounts to retweet them a lot, therefore amplifying and creating the perception that whatever was being said, whatever was being shared, was much more popular than really it was. And that seems to be sort of the game plan here. It's just, you know, post a bunch, retweet a bunch, and never log off. So, you know, whenever the, you know, senior citizen version of this podcast comes out, you know, you guys keep an eye on the landscape and let me know. I'm sure it's somewhere down the pipe. You say you want war, little boys, you sure? You say you want war, little boys, you sure? You say you want war, little boys, you sure? You say you want war, little boys, you sure? Well, spin it through and leave his brands in the score. Spin it through and leave his brands in the score. Joining Shiphost now, we have Will Sommer, my good friend, the reporter at the Daily Beast. Will, what's up, man? Welcome back to the show.
Hey, I'm always happy to be here.
It's always great to have you on. That's why you're on so often. So we've been off at the show for a couple weeks, and, you know, that means the listeners of Shitpost are probably like sponges dried up next to the sink, just needing like that hit of weird right-wing shit to, I guess, be educated about. So I thought you'd be a great person to bring in and do like a temperature reading on what is happening right now. If you, in the most vague sense, in a general abstract, if you were to stick a temperature into the, Christmas turkey of the MAGA movement right now, what's the vibe that you're getting?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. He's kind of spinning up all these claims. Of course, John Solomon, who formerly of The Hill, he's in the mix. And in general, I would say the vibe is like kind of down across the board. Obviously, there's a lot of different factions we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But I mean, really, from everywhere from QAnon to like Fox News and Hannity, I feel like no one's kind of like figured out. Like in the way that with the Mueller investigation, I think they came up with a pretty competent counter narrative, which was like, you know, Andrew McCabe, his wife, you know, is in with Hillary and all this stuff. Like, obviously, the Peter Strzok text messages were very helpful. But in this case, I really don't think they've approached anything like that.
Right. Yeah. This is something I was talking about with some of my coworkers today in the office, where it's just like, this does not feel totally put together as far as pushback goes. Like, it's, you know, what you just said is exactly right. With the Mueller thing, they pushed back on it pretty aggressively, and who they managed to convince is thoroughly convinced. The Kavanaugh stuff, they pushed back on that really hard. That was very focused, very, you know, they went at that. But this impeachment stuff, I feel like, and maybe I am attributing like too much of a conscious to like the greater political machine in America, but like some of this stuff does seem to be almost too absurd to defend. When you have Trump in the cabinet room today being like, "You reporters and your dang emoluments clause nonsense." It's like, at some point, you know, if you're a pundit, do you look at that and you say you can't defend it? I don't know. What's your impression?
I think that's a great point. I mean, I think it doesn't help that, you know, you have someone like Mick Mulvaney coming out and scrambling like the whole defense, right? And he's like, yeah, there was a quid pro quo. Who cares, right? Get over it. Or as you mentioned, Trump just kind of seems to be even less hinged than usual. And so I think that's kind of making it hard for someone like Greg Jarrett or Sean Hannity to, like, you know, if they have to change up the play every night.
Right. Yeah. And it just seems like I'm getting the sense of like some exhaustion starting to set in. So I guess we'll just have to see like where that goes from here. Something else I really want to discuss is the latest hot burning red sizzling scoop from Project Veritas that CNN does news reporting. Can you tell us about
this? Yeah, so this is a classic. I mean, you know, as someone who is probably no surprise to Shitpost listeners, I'm like a real hound for all media gossip, you know, not just right-wing media. So the prospect of, you know, James O'Keefe is always promising to drop these, like, really, like, spicy tapes on, you know, he tried it with the Washington Post, CNN. And, you know, as a media gadfly...
Yeah, you're like, ooh, someone's going to get in trouble.
And each time... Yeah, exactly. Each time, you know, sort of just like with, like, Jacob Wool and Jack Berkman, of course. These guys, like, each time it's sort of like, maybe it's real this time, right? And then, especially with O'Keefe, and then it never is. And, you know, his first videos always come out, and then they're kind of like, really, that's it? And he's like, well, there's more to come. And then, you know, it just kind of goes from there. So, in this case, James O'Keefe found a satellite uplink contractor named Carrie Porch, who, you know, claims to have been just so shocked by what he saw at CNN that he started wearing a hidden camera. But these tapes really, like, he taped the company-wide call each morning, which clearly Jeff Zucker is aware is, like, quite leakable in general. And, you know, and then he wore a hidden camera around, and you see him interacting with some CNN personalities, but apparently none of that footage was at all interesting, because it's like, oh, Dana Bash in an elevator.
Yeah, and, but, like, and then there's no tape of Dana Bash saying anything.
Exactly.
It's just the guy who's, like, working the sound stage, just being like, man, this is bullshit. I hate this place.
Yeah, no. Well, and so many of the people they bust are, like, complaining about, like, just not liking CNN. Or it's not even, per se, like, about bias. Like, some of the, you know, they caught a couple, like, low-level employees that this guy took out for drinks. And you can, it's always interesting in these videos where you can tell the O'Keefe agent, like, prompting the people to say something. And then, so these kids said stuff like, oh, you know, like, one of these guys is, like, literally, like, 22, you like just graduated from college. And so he's like, yeah, you know, I think you know, we shouldn't play so much Trump rallies, because, like, we never play Biden or Warren rallies because they're so boring, but then we just play Trump rallies all the time. And then it's like, that's bias of some kind, I guess.
Right. Yeah, that's more of just like the bias of a news network valuing money over, like, substance, you know.
Right.
like that could be something interesting there, but instead, it's spun a different way. And
right. Like, all the things that, like, these calls that he busts them on, where they say, okay, what are we covering today? And they're like, well, MSNBC is doing a gun town hall. And he's like, who cares? Let's just focus on impeachment. Well, like, that's yeah, it's like a far bigger story, you know? And that comes down to news judgment and that sort of stuff. But there's no, I mean, the idea that Jeff Zucker has concocted the impeachment hearings or something is obviously not true.
Yeah, I feel like this is something that happened with the last Project Veritas thing, that whole, like, Google Insider information. the information that these Google insiders had was interesting for, like, in some respect, but it wasn't what they said it was, right? It's like, this proves Google has a bias, and then it's like, oh, this is interesting. Google is being, like, really proactive in making sure that they're not sending push alerts to people from, like, gunloveliberty.com and, like, unprompted, or sort of the different mechanisms that Google uses to try to tamp down conspiracy theories in recent years after, you know, mass shootings and that sort of stuff. You know, material that is interesting to sort of see under the hood of, like, exactly what they're trying to do. But instead, James O'Keefe wheels it out, and I can still picture him in the, you know, acorn pimp costume just being like, all right, fellas, we got a scoop. And I haven't seen a lot of people in right-wing media pick up the CNN thing and treat it very seriously. Is there anyone out there that's, like, really, really pumped for this?
I mean, aside from just sort of, like, random Twitter goons, I would say, with, like, 40,000 followers and, like, they're following 40,000 people and that kind of stuff, like the Michael Flynn star emoji is in the name. I mean, you know, even Jesse Waters at Fox was like, eh, this kind of stinks, you know, this isn't anything. And I mean, that's a guy who knows, like, video stunts, you know, certainly. So I think this is kind of a flop. I think the Google comparison is right, that it seems like so much of O'Keefe's stuff is, like, the secrecy and then the fact that he got something is the excitement. But then it turns out to, like, the actual contents of it really don't matter. And, you know, I think he's a little insecure about this. James has been coming at me hard on Twitter.
Oh, I've seen that,
he,
yeah.
He very specifically screenshotted my newsletter and was just like, you know. Of course, because now Trump has filed or is threatening to sue CNN over this in a bizarre, like, false claims thing. Like, I mean, it's just absolute nonsense, but O'Keefe was like, you know, Will, you have egg on your face now. And I was like, my face remains eggless. No egg, no egg here.
No egg. Do not worry, James. I'm doing just fine. He went after me one time because I made fun of him for comparing himself to Hunter S. Thompson. And he's like, well, actually, Mr. Holt, you should read some of the work of Mr. Thompson. And I was like, I have read Hunter Thompson religiously.
Look, buddy, we've all been 13.
Yeah, listen. I definitely stayed up late one night on a school night and watched Fear and Loathing.
Yes, so. Exactly.
And I don't think this is it. Oh, man. So still, we're going around the circle of sort of the latest bumblings in right-wing media, some of your latest reporting. One of those stories focuses on this anti-China propaganda film that Steve Bannon, who is a former campaign manager, advisor?
Former Trump advisor, yeah.
Yeah, high-level Trump advisor, has produced with the Epoch Times. This is the problem of just reading your news.
Right.
You say it in your head. Tell us about this film. You were telling me earlier you got a screener version of it, so
yes.
You've seen the film.
Yeah, so this is the very subtly named Claws of the Red Dragon.
Huh, I wonder what that's about.
So, you know, so sort of the backstory here is that Epoch Times is closely linked, if not the exact same thing as Falun Gong, this Chinese spiritual movement that has been pretty quite repressed by the Chinese government. So they do seem to have some legitimate grievances. But their plan in the Trump era has been to, because they see Trump clashing with China, so they have gone all in on right-wing media, both in TV and their website. And, I mean, you know, you were at CPAC with me, and they were, like, sitting down with Gorka and the whole gang. So, by the way, these are also the people, of course, who do the Shen Yun dance troupe.
Oh, yeah. Massively underrated part of this whole saga with the Epoch Times. I feel like every story should also mention the fact that, like, there's a beautiful song and dance performance also associated with this movie.
So, I mean, you know, so this was all sort of like the, you know, reported very well by Ben Collins and Brandi Zarozny at NBC News. But so Steve Bannon is kind of like, you know, footloose and fancy free. He's a Ronin, a masterless samurai. And, you know, now that his attempt to turn this monastery into some sort of like far right training camp in Italy failed, he's teamed up with the Epoch Times to make this movie, and it's based on the recent arrest of that Huawei executive in Canada.
Mm, yeah. So the movie, Rotten Tomatoes, like, what did you think?
Yeah, that's it's you know, five rotten tomatoes or whatever for me. It's a stinker. You know, it's Steve Bannon said he was very impressed with the quality of the production. You know, I don't know if he's seen a movie before, but yeah, I mean, basically, like, if you love people arguing about extradition and bail, you'll love Claws of the Red Dragon.
I couldn't imagine a more glowing review.
But it's very so basically the plot is there's this female, this Chinese Canadian reporter who's put on covering this extradition, and she kind of her boyfriend works for this Huawei stand-in, the nearly identically named Hua Xing. And so basically his Chinese overlords are trying to get him to sabotage her story. She refuses. He sort of contemplates suicide at the end of the movie. But this is kind of the movie where people are saying a lot of, like, remember our secret plan. And it's like, yes, master.
gotta love it. That just grade A filmmaking, it sounds like.
At one point, a dead cat is put on the reporter's car as a sort of warning. And there's this scene where she and her boyfriend are just yelling. She's like, did you put the dead cat on my car? And he's like, I don't know anything about dead cats. Just like back and
forth. Oh, man. But the thing is, you know, I guess this Bannon film has been in production for, you know, since before this NBC report from Ben and Brandy came out. But even since then, it doesn't seem that, like, the MAGA universe has really been too deterred away from the Epoch Times since that report, which is, I feel like the age we're living in, I'm always like both like, well, that's kind of surprising. But then I think about it for a second and I'm like, is anything surprising? What is the meaning of life? This is just but the duality of the human existence. And I, you know, hit the vape and like fall asleep.
I mean, I think that's a pretty good reaction to our times. I mean, the other kind of key thing about Falun Gong, right, is that they reportedly believe that Trump is going to help usher in the end times.
Right.
So this is, you know, there's some apocalyptic leanings here. And so I asked Bannon about that. I'm like, do you think that's a little weird? You know, your old boss, they think he's like this messianic figure. And he's like, hey, you know, if they like Trump, they like Trump. And he's like, you know, some of the deplorables feel that way too. And it's like, oh Steve, it's come to this.
Yeah, but I mean, do you think it could be that, like, why we haven't seen these MAGA people sort of back off the Epoch Times? Like, do you think maybe it could be just that the ideology is simply not far enough away from, like, the cult of personality around Trump? Or is there anything else you've seen that might indicate why people are sticking around? Obviously, we can't speak for every single person or anything.
Sure. I mean, I think they love that. I mean, Epoch Times, I think, are some of Trump's, in a weird way, like, most effective, allies in the conservative media, in terms of, especially with the Mueller investigation. I mean, they would create these like giant crazy wall maps and just print them in the Epoch Times that were just like, you know, like Peter Strzok, like connections. And to any sane person, you'd be like, this is nuts. But for all these people who were looking for any reason to defend Trump, they loved it and they got really into it based on that. So, I mean, certainly, you know, they share an abiding sort of fascination with Donald Trump.
Other people that have a fascinating, we're just going to keep clocking through these, man. Other people that have fascinating interpretations and obsessions with the president are people who are now running for office in his namesake. We have Joey drinks his own piss salads, Laura Loomer, some big league politics guy is running.
Peter DiBrasco.
Yeah, I just remember that's the guy who wrote that article that because I said Nick Cage should have never given the Constitution back, that I like hate America or something.
Yeah, Peter's a, you know, a kind of unique character. It seems like he's no longer with Big League. It's interesting because he's running. Usually these people pick kind of a prominent Democrat to run against that they'll definitely lose to. Omar Navarro against Maxine Waters, Deanna Lorraine's running against Pelosi. She doesn't even live in the district, or didn't when she announced. But in Peter's case, he's running against this like random Republican member of the House in North Carolina, and he's claiming this guy isn't far right enough because like Peter's like, I want a 10-year ban on all forms of immigration, and so that guy's like, well, I don't know about that.
Oh God, yeah, and who's Loomer?
Right, so she's running against a comparatively little-known Democrat named Lois Frankel in Florida. But the thing is, that district is like you know, there's 0% chance Laura's going to win that general election if she makes it through the primary.
What is the over-under that she saw Lois Frankel and thought it said Louis Farrakhan and decided to run?
It is. I mean, but that said, I mean, I think she has a pretty good chance in that primary. She raised $145,000, as I think your colleagues at Right Wing Watch discovered. There were like 3 or 4 people who actually live in Florida who donated to her.
No, that was Nikki Ramirez. Oh, right. Media Matters. Yeah. But yeah, it was like all out of state money.
Yeah. So, I mean, but nevertheless, you know, and obviously she'll get a lot of media attention, at least from conservatives. You know, I mean, I don't know how many people are really banking on what Paul Gosar in Congress tells them to do, but he's all behind her. So, you know, I think if she makes it through the primary, that could be interesting. And really, there are the other candidates from what I've seen are kind of similar levels of normalcy, but much less famous.
Right, right. Yeah. It's, I mean, that is like politicking 101 strategy, though, right? Where it's, you know, if you want to affect change and move a country in a certain direction, you start local and build up. So it makes sense that people are like running for these state level offices. And then, of course, we have the bigger figures who are maybe more ambitious, or, you know, perhaps think they could sucker more people out of money, so that I won't make any accusatory statements here.
Well, you know, the other thing to highlight about the Loomer campaign, I don't know if you saw this, they endorsed this fan-made video that is truly haunting. So, you know, that Chinese animation studio that does all the events in the news, they've kind of dropped off the, you know, they would have like, you know, someone fighting a panda or something. It was all animated.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they where did that go?
Yeah. So this person kind of seems to have gotten their hands on the same software, but like much, much worse. So basically, like, they made these fan videos of Laura, but like it she kind of looks like a sim. Like it's not a very like flattering portrayal, I would say. But so it's like her as like a queen, or like her just being like chasing AOC and all this stuff, and there, but like it's very like Uncanny Valley. I don't like it. But she was, her campaign was thrilled.
Oh, God. I hate that you told me that, because now I'm going to go find it. Oh, man. And I guess sort of the last thing we'll get to, we'll circle back around to impeachment. I bumped into you last week at the March for Trump in D.C., which, you know, what can you say about it? These people were passionate. They knew what they stood for. I'll say that. Your general read, and you know, we can talk about this buses thing, mm-hmm. but before we get to the buses, which was the big drama of the morning, everybody wanted to know what happened to the buses. You know, let's in the words of Felix Biederman, vibe check.
Yeah. So, you know, this is the this was mostly, you know, sort of baby boomers, nearly all white, you know, kind of your classic Fox News demo. There were a couple hundred of them. And, you know, after, so they had this event, it was a couple congressmen, Gorka, Jack Posobiec. And then, of course, they marched over to Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff's office. You went to Schiff, I went to Pelosi. And it was so bizarre watching these people who, number one, are not Pelosi's constituents in any way,
no,
but sort of like feel the deep need to like kind of get their way. And so they went into the office and they were like, where is Pelosi? A couple dozen of them. And the guy was like, well, yeah, she's not here. And they were like, oh, well, you tell her to, you know, stop this show trial. And the guy was like, okie doke, I'll tell her that. And they were like, are you taking this down? And so this is also, I should say, like a 20-something staffer with a standing desk. And he's clearly ignoring them, and they're just like ranting, and he's just like type and they're just like, are you taking this down? Let me see. And he's like, I'm not gonna let you see my computer. And so there was a closed meeting room door off to the side, and I was kind of in the back watching this whole show go down, and this woman became convinced that Pelosi was hiding behind the door.
Oh, hell yeah.
And she's going like, Nancy, stop the coup. Stop the coup, Nancy. And then the guy's like, hey, like, stop bothering that meeting. And she's just like, Nancy.
What I saw outside of Adam Schiff's office is these like older women, one of them had an InfoWars shirt on, being like, they turned the corner. I got there a little bit before their group did. So they come out of the elevators and they turn the corner, And then the first words out of her mouth are, "Wow, there it is." And then they like all, they just sort of like linger in the hallway. They take bathroom breaks and they wait until they get like a big enough group. And then the police officer rounds around the corner and they're like, "Oh no, they sent the cops after us to stop us from confronting Pelosi." And then the cop was like, "You know, when I'm not in a uniform, I'm actually a deplorable too." I was like, "Oh, Jesus Christ, man." So they felt all right. And then they're like, "All right, do we just knock on the door?" And he's like, "You know, you just walk in. You just open the door and go in." They walk in. They're like, "Hi, we would like to talk to Adam Schiff." And the same thing, like, young 20-something woman working the desk. It's like, "Oh, he's not here. I can take a note." And then they sort of huddle and they're like, "Oh, what do we do? They're like, "Okay, yeah, we'll leave a note." And they like are crowdsourcing this note. Very polite note, I will give them credit. But while I'm in there, the woman in the InfoWars shirt turns and sees a picture of Adam Schiff and Barack Obama. It's like, there they are in the basement colluding, which I can only assume is a Pizzagate reference. Like, there they are in the basement colluding to take out the president. And then everyone in the group turns and they're like, "Oh, wow. Whoa, makes you sick." <It's>
like, Well, that's a very classic, like Pizzagate thing. I mean, obviously not just the basement, but the idea that, like, at this secret meeting, they would be like, "Okay, put the picture on your wall."
Yeah. "Oh, this very secretive underground blood sacrifice, which we have high-resolution photos of somehow." Oh, man. I've been talking here with Will Sommer. He's a reporter at The Daily Beast. He covers a lot of right-wing stuff, so he's a friend of the pod indeed. Will, you've been on the podcast many times before. You know this final question, and you seemed very excited to answer it earlier. What's your favorite thing on the internet right now?
Yeah, so, you know, as you said, I've mentioned this several times in the lead up to this podcast. It's the primary reason I agreed to this, so I can share this. Have you seen this crocodile receptionist thing?
Tell me
this
more.
This is a pretty, like, this didn't get a lot of attention, but I've been obsessed with it. I texted it to, like, 20 people. So it's like a picture, it's like a real life picture of, like, a crocodile in, he's wearing a suit, and he's, like, in an office, like, at a keyboard. And then the style is kind of like, looks like kind of those deep fried memes, right? So there's a lot of like image degradation. And then the text over it says, "Crocodile receptionist," and it's just like laughing emoji. And then it's like, "Not gonna lie, he do be scheduling meetings though." And then there's kind of like a quizzical emoji. It's just, I texted it to like 20 people and literally none of them responded. They're just like,
But you said it's a real picture?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the crocodile, there is a real life crocodile who is dressed up.
And he's a receptionist.
Yeah, well, yes, exactly. I was like, wow, strange stuff.
I'm really glad that you agreed to do this podcast to share this with everybody.
I'm trying to get it to catch on a little better. I think it deserves more attention.
Will, plug your shit. Where can people find you and the work you're up to?
Absolutely. So Will Sommer, S-O-M-M-E-R on Twitter. And then I'm at The Daily Beast a couple times a week. And my newsletter, Wright Richter, Richter like the Richter scale. Just go to WrightRichter.com and comes out more or less every week.
Yeah, that tends to be how newsletters go, where it's like, yes. Will, thanks so much for coming on the show again. We'll have to have you on again soon, I'm sure.
Absolutely, thanks for having me. Interior crocodile alligator. I drive a Chevrolet movie theater. Interior crocodile alligator. I drive a Chevrolet movie theater. Interior crocodile alligator.
The anonymous messaging app Kick is coming back. Media Lab just acquired that app and plans to invest in its future. Kick was kind of headed towards the grave because Kick Interactive, which was the company that owned it, really thought that like cryptocurrency was going to be the next big thing and was kind of, you know, saying that they were done with Kick. But Media Lab, which is based in LA, they are adding Kick to their what seems to be like a growing portfolio of anonymous messaging apps. They've already got Whisper, which is very similar, and we might see it merge. But something else that's interesting is Media Lab and Whisper have stayed afloat, even though other apps like Secret and Yik Yak was huge on my college campus, even though those have shut down, these have sort of held up. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with Kick and what Media Lab does with it. But for those who enjoy using it, you can rest assured that it's going to be here to stay for a little bit. Last week, Juul Labs, the e-cigarette manufacturer, announced that it would be suspending the sale of fruity-flavored vape pods until those pods are reviewed by the FDA. This seems to be a very apparent attempt to get ahead of the Trump administration, which announced in September that it would move to ban all flavored vapes from the U.S. market. In the next few months, the FDA is expected to release regulatory guidance to removing these vaping products from the market until they can be tested by the FDA. Until this sort of works itself out to its conclusion, mango, cream, fruit, and cucumber-flavored vape pods are no longer available for sale until they get that FDA seal of approval. And that's going to do it for Shitpost this week. Thanks for listening, and again, thanks for all the support and the care and the patience that you guys have had with me while I've been sort of working on some stuff offline and trying to spend time with family and everything. It means a lot that you guys have my back. And as much as I love doing this show and as much as, you know, I'm happy to deliver it to you guys weekly, sometimes life just happens and I've got to take a step back. So thanks for being there, and I'll catch you next week.